Hi, everyone. Welcome back. It's 2024, first episode of the new year. January 17, 2024. My name is Colin Datsuba. I'm your host, the host of Metropolis. Today, we're talking about housing. The city and other levels of government have been doing their best to fix the housing crisis, so they say. It doesn't seem fixed to me, Gavin. Does it seem fixed to you?
No, not really. Yeah. Not entirely.
Yeah. Today's guest is Gavin Armitage Ackerman, urban planning researcher and housing policy analyst.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, thank you for coming on, Gavin.
Yeah.
We got a lot to discuss. Housing crisis. Yeah, it's still a crisis, I would say.
Yeah, well, it depends how you look at it, you know. I mean, some people would say it's a crisis. Some people would maybe say, you know, the housing system is maybe designed to be working like this in a certain way. And we're going to be diving into that a little bit in our discussion.
Who would say such a thing?
Probably me. I would probably say that.
All right, terrific. Yeah, so today we have a couple articles to discuss, some news that was happening over the holidays. First up, we're going to be talking about the Ilo Voyageur project. This is the former bus terminal near Barrie-Ukam. What was that? That's the corner of Barrie and Ontario? Or Maisonneuve, I think. Maisonneuve. Barrie and Maisonneuve. The city's buying up, has bought the land there, and now they're announcing a new project there for affordable housing. City has also announced another project on Ontario Street. Valerie Plante made the announcement with Member of Parliament, Stephen Guilbeault. About 191 new affordable and social housing units are coming to Ontario and Saint-Denis. And then also, some news about prices, home prices in Montreal. They're going up. Home prices are going up, even though sales are going down.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell's that about? And then finally, a little note on gentrification. We have a venue in Montreal, a beloved punk venue, that is getting noise complaints. The punks are getting noise complaints. What's new? Yeah, let's go to our first slide. Oh, there it is. There it is, that beautiful lot.
Yeah, not the nicest. Yeah, that's pretty derelict right now.
Yeah. So let me read the little quote I have. So this is from a CTV News article entitled Montreal Accepting Proposals for Ilo Voyageur Sud Social Housing Project. The Ilo Voyageur redevelopment project will contribute directly to combating the housing crisis while revitalizing a key downtown area, said Montreal Mayor Valerie Plante. This project demonstrates the importance of continuing our ambitious strategy of land and building acquisitions to ensure that social and affordable housing projects continue to spring up all over the metropolis. The potential project could cover an area of nearly 650,000 net square feet and accommodate more than 700 units. City officials, they say they will favor proposals that offer the most affordable units. Gavin, you actually worked on a proposal for this site.
I did.
Something of the sort. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I am an urban planning student, and I do research on affordable housing and gentrification, housing development, these sorts of things. So along with my colleague, Brady Yano, who I got to give a shout out, he did a lot of work on this project with me. We proposed a development for about 400 to 450 social housing units and student housing on the site. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting site. I mean, it represents a really interesting opportunity for the city of Montreal. I think they bought the land for about $18 million, maybe $18.5 million, if my memory serves me right, which is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you want to build social housing and nonprofit housing, cooperative housing, anything like that, you know, not only is building, you know, they want towers of social housing, 23 stories, I believe. Not only is that, you know, prohibitively expensive, but then, you know, social housing developers would have to spend an extra $18 or more million on acquiring mm-hmm. that land. So if the city's willing to lease it out long term, maybe donate it or sell it for a dollar, you know, it's a really awesome opportunity for a social housing developer if they do actually, you know, follow through on that and prioritize a social housing developer mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, an affordable housing developer or just market rate housing.
So could you go into the distinction that, say, because I always see this a lot in, like, discussions around, like, housing policy. People talk yeah. about public housing, social housing, affordable housing. Sometimes people use them a little interchangeably, but I don't think that's quite accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely intended to be used that way. I think that there's some like intentional ambiguity around sort of the language, so that I think, you know, politicians have an easier time pitching projects. Affordable housing and social housing are quite different. Every city has sort of their own definition of what affordable housing is. But generally, affordable housing, at least in Montreal, just means housing that is below the average rent or cost, which, you know, as you know, we both know, like the price of housing in Montreal, we'll talk about this in a bit, I believe, the price of housing in Montreal and all across Canada has kind of been skyrocketing over the last decade and longer. And so as prices continue to go up and up and up, you know, the affordable housing threshold also goes up because it's really just tied to, you know, below average, and that average keeps increasing. So it's not really that useful. You know, you compare that to social housing, and again, social housing works differently in different provinces and cities, but social housing is really just, you know, forms of non-profit housing that can be both, you know, privately non-profit funded or from the government. So the big difference really, just to sum it up, is just affordable is just market rate housing that is below the average. Social housing is not market rate. And in Quebec, typically social housing is generally, you know, fixed to your income. So a lot of them will be, you know, 25% of your income for rent, regardless of what your income is. Those sorts of things.
So I guess so. Both of them are kind of like these loose terms. Affordable being much more tied to the market rate, which is always kind of in flux, always sort of like going up. Like maybe like in a few years, if all rents across Montreal go up, then these housing units that are going to be at whatever price are also going to go up with it.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And yeah, especially if they are, I mean, that's another really important distinction that you mentioned is like, you know, you can build an affordable housing unit and then, you know, what happens when that person moves out and another person moves in 5 years down the line, you know, those rents are just going to increase with the market. Like they're not really protected in any meaningful way. We do have rent control, obviously, in Quebec, but it only protects you when you're, you know, in the unit, you know, consecutively. As soon as that person moves out, you know, the private, you know, landlord who owns this new development is just obviously going to raise the rent on them. Social housing is not going to be the case because it's not subject to market forces, which is really important for, you know, vulnerable people.
I think, so one thing that's interesting, you're talking about this piece of land, the Île-Voyageurs area, being bought for $18 million. That's a steep price, and you were saying before that because the city is kind of putting up the cash for that and buying this land and then offering it up to developers or opening to proposals, there's that kind of cost of entry that is now maybe more... It's like this area is more accessible to some social housing developers.
Yeah.
Where before, like let's say like if the city hadn't bought it, then it would have been up to the social housing developer to put up that kind of cash, right? Which is very unlikely to get.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, like, I mean, especially in this area, it's a really dense downtown area. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of land that's actually like widely available to build. Like, I mean, they want to, I think, have 700 or more social housing units on this site, which is a huge amount of housing, at least just to build for one project, especially social housing. You know, that's, you know, it's a really, really big piece of land. It's pretty unprecedented. Yeah. And being able to, like, foot the bill for social housing developers is just going to make it that much easier for them to, you know, build as many, maximize, you know, sort of the potential of the site.
700 units is incredibly large, yeah. And this is all part of the city in their budget, their 2024 budget. They have $582.3 million set aside for affordable, social, and community housing. Of that $582.3 million, $555.3 million, so like the vast majority of that money, is set aside for acquiring this kind of land, right?
Yeah.
And I think something about that, to me, is interesting. I kind of want your take on it. It's the fact that the city, I guess, has to, like, the city has to earmark so much money, right, just for this land acquisition, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like the ticket is so high to get this kind of, like, ball rolling, which I guess is, like, it's good to see that they're earmarking like almost like half a billion dollars, right, for this. But like sometimes I wonder, is like, is there kind of other ways to go about it? Is this, what do you think of this kind of approach from the city?
Well, I do think it's a pretty good approach for a few reasons. You know, the first one would be that, you know, actually putting money aside for them to develop the housing themselves. I mean, that's actually, it's a very difficult process, and you do need, you know, people, trained developers and people to actually, you know, kind of understand how to do it efficiently and effectively. So I do think that in that sense, it's good to focus on acquiring the land. You know, there's also the reason that we already kind of said, which is that it really opens the door for nonprofit developers to come in who don't have to now foot this giant bill to get the land. So that's good in that sense. I would say that another reason that I do think it's a pretty good strategy is that there's sort of like, you know, long-term affordability benefits to it. So if the city owns the land, you know, no matter who they're leasing that land to, presuming that the city, you know, leases the land or maybe sells it with certain clauses in it, they can actually control the affordability of those projects, which is like a huge benefit. This is sort of a common theme with community land trusts, which are becoming pretty popular, and there's a lot of really successful examples, you know, in Canada, like, you know, here, you know, in downtown Montreal, there are examples.
Before, could you explain what a community land trust is?
Yes, exactly. So a community land trust is basically a way of decommodifying land, taking it off the market, and basically just holding it in common under a, you know, under what's called a trust. But yeah, basically just legally takes it off the market. But what's really great about it is that the land itself is owned by this nonprofit organization or entity with a stated social goal, where they're like, we're not, you know, intending on owning all this land and then building luxury condos on it, you know. That community land trust, the organization who owns all that land, can say anything that's built here is not going to be subject to market forces. It's all going to be affordable, long-term. You know, and the city can kind of take an approach like that, obviously different from a land trust in a sense. But, you know, the city can own the land similarly and impose certain rules and regulations and say, you know, they could even go to a private developer and say, "Well, actually, we'll lease you this public land that we own, but only under the condition that, you know, it must be affordable in the long term."
Right.
I don't know if that.
I guess so. What I'm understanding is, if we look at community land trusts and the way they kind of take housing off the market under their control, there's a sort of kind of democratic element to it, I guess, where it's like the tenants and the people living in these buildings get to kind of sort of decide what is done with whatever amount of units are in the trust. And I guess for the city to be acquiring land and then having control of the land and the units that are going to be built there, it's sort of something similar where you still have the land and then the eventual properties on the land sort of attached to this democratic instrument that is, like, let's say the municipal government, right?
Yeah. The difference really is just that I think, like you say, the democratic element's actually a really defining difference. So, you know, in the case of the community land trust, it is, like, participatory and democratic.
Right.
And, you know, the people living there or potentially owning properties, or, like, not properties, but they're owning homes on that land, on that property, or leasing out the land from the land trust. They're all involved in sort of the ownership and the management and that type of thing, generally. In the case of the city, I mean, I think you still get a lot of the same benefits, but obviously, I think one of the nice things about a community land trust, and why, you know, if it was up to me, I would say the city should, you know, basically turn this into a land trust or, you know, start developing more land trusts, is that you don't have to worry about, you know, let's say a more conservative government comes in and goes, we don't want this land. I mean, this is kind of what happened in New York, actually. There was a bunch of publicly owned land, and rather than give it to a community land trust, I believe it was Michael Bloomberg came in and was basically like, we're just going to sell this all off to private developers for $1. Like, insanely valuable land. So, yeah. basically, like, if the city owns it, you do have to worry. Like, I'm like, are they just going to, like, give it away for free?
No, no, right? I know what you mean. I've heard similar things with, like, friends who work at, like, charities or NGOs. And, like, I ask about, like, I ask them, like, what percentage of, like, the funding comes from, like, the government and stuff
yeah.
like that. And this one friend who used to work for Dans la Rue, like, one of the, you know Dans la Rue? It's, like, this organization.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They do work with, like, sort of, like, youth experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that a lot of the money they have to rely on is from donors,
yeah.
Private donors,
yeah.
rather than the government, because their concern is if they rely on the government and then it switches, like you're saying, like if
yeah.
like the federal government, provincial government switches to one that's more conservative, their funding is cut, then that's like the rug being pulled under them, right? What
yeah.
what defense do you have for that? You have nothing.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I guess the risk you're saying is something similar for City Hall, where it's like, of course it's good that they're accruing this kind of property, they're accruing all these units, but then there's that risk of like, if the tide turns, it's someone more right wing, someone whose priority is not public housing, so someone whose priority is not like amending the housing crisis and offering let's say democratic or tenant focused solutions,
yeah.
then all these units could just be like gone, and all the problems
yeah.
could be gone.
Yeah, absolutely. That could happen, which would be obviously really unfortunate.
That would be bad.
That would be not good. I wouldn't endorse that.
Yeah.
but I would say it is. It does. You know, it's kind of stressful to think about, because like basically
don't think about it too much.
Yeah. the city of Montreal, they recently acquired, this is a new thing for municipalities in Quebec, the right to expropriate land, basically, or the right to buy. So the city, you know, I believe this is how they exercised their right to buy this particular property, but I might be wrong. But in general, the city of Montreal has been kind of pursuing this new strategy of land banking, mm-hmm. using this right to buy, which is that, you know, if there's a property on the market, and let's say you own a property, you're Mr. Moneybags, you got a mm-hmm. bunch of mm-hmm. properties. Yeah, you own a property, you know, and just imagine you got your big bags of money, you know.
One property, please.
Yeah. And then you're going to sell a property with, you know, I don't know, let's just say it was this property that's really valuable to the local community or tenants or whatever. The city actually now has the right to come in and buy that property.
The city's like, excuse me.
Yeah. They can basically just intervene and be like,
can I get in on that?
Yeah. They're like, we'd rather get that. And, you know, so if you want to sell it for $10 million, well, the city has the right to come in and be like, well, we'll take it for $10 million.
Well,
so, yeah, which is it's an interesting thing, but the problem is, they're sort of doing this land banking where they're just sort of like accumulating a decent amount of land, which is great.
Love this here.
Yeah, it's awesome. But then a lot of these properties are just sort of sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is one in Park Extension. I'm forgetting the name of the property, but there was a building that I believe now is just empty. Like, there's no one living in it. I don't know if the people living there were evicted or I don't know what happened, but it's been sitting there for like a few years, and like the city, it was great. The city came in and bought it with this, you know, this new right to buy, mm-hmm. But they're really reliant on provincial or federal funds to do anything with it, you know.
They have enough money to like buy it, but then like after that, they just
They don't really, you know, money does not come for housing, especially does not come from the municipality. Mm-hmm. It overwhelmingly comes from the province, and we have a more conservative-leaning provincial government who has shown that they're not really interested in funding mm-hmm. social housing like previous governments.
François Legault and the CAC.
Yeah. Ah, hate those guys. No, but, you know, they just, the money's just not there.
Uh-huh.
And building housing is really, really expensive, you know. So a lot of these are just kind of sitting empty. And the worry is that, you know, a new government's going to come in and go, well, we're just sitting on all this land and we want to balance the books, so let's just sell all this.
Right, right. It's going to be, let's balance the books, let's get a bit of cash. And then also, like, they can be like, the past government, they took too long, or
yeah.
or this is kind of eating up too much of our money, like you're
yeah.
saying, balancing the books.
Yeah.
Let's go on to another thing, because I think there's something interesting about, you talk about the city needing financial help from like federal and provincial government. So here we have an article in Call Montreal entitled 191 new social and affordable housing units come to Montreal. 191, wow. This is by Lorraine Carpenter. The subheadings reads, a joint investment of $80.5 million from all three levels of government will fund three housing projects in the city. So Montreal Mayor, the article continues, Montreal Mayor Valérie Plante and Ville-Marie MP Stephen Guilbeault, he's not the MP of Ville-Marie, he's the MP of Laurier-Sainte-Marie. Lorraine, come on now. Lori Yixing Mahi, MP Stephen Yubo, among others, announced a new joint investment of $80.5 million by the municipal, provincial, and federal governments in 191 social and affordable housing units in the city. The spaces will reportedly include a supervised rooming house for men on social assistance who are on the verge of homelessness, located on the former bed and breakfast on Ontario Street near St. Denis, as well as a new housing for women run by the Women's Downtown YWCA and units for formerly homeless teens and young adults.
Yeah, so there you go.
That's good.
thanks.
That's good recap.
I actually realized there's something on the paper I need to read.
Yeah.
So here we have, a comparatively a smaller project than the last one we were discussing. The last one has the potential for more than 700 units. These three projects, it's something like, 191 in total, right?
Yeah.
It does seem like these, the last one seems to be just general kind of open developments. It could be anything. This one is much more strictly, I think, targeted towards helping people who are kind of... sort of like at risk of homelessness. You have new housing for women, formerly homeless teens and young adults. So you have these kind of, there's a name for this. They don't call it halfway houses anymore, but sort of like helping people kind of like get back on their feet.
Transitional housing.
Transitional housing,
typically,
That. But some critics, there are critics, of course, everyone's a critic, ourselves included, but. Yet the latest headcount for Montreal's unhoused population suggests 4,500 people are in urgent need of a roof. Mayor Valerie Plante admits it's an administrative headache because it involves the municipal, provincial, and federal governments. This is from an article on CTV by Stéphane Giroux. Here we have, it's good news. It's always good to see these kinds of units being put up, especially with Chedoras kind of experiencing this like temporary pause because of they had difficulty with funding and staffing. Mm-hmm. They're back open now.
Yeah, it's great.
And it's cool to see these kinds of units popping up. I think they have, so of that $582.3 million that the city has allocated for housing, 6.5 of that is for homelessness. And this money from the city, federal government, clearly kind of adds to that. But yeah, I'm kind of curious what you think of it. I mean, to me, 191 units is great, especially for people experiencing homelessness, but it's like, seems inadequate. And it seems like something people were saying, you'll see in this next slide, it's not a fast process.
It's not, as it says right there.
It took
5 years for our project to get off the ground to build 54 rooms for at-risk seniors. That's a pretty long time.
You do my job now.
Yeah, sorry.
What the heck?
Yeah, go ahead.
to feed this into our discussion earlier, I guess. Here you're going to have the city kind of using their money, using the kind of resources that are available to them, as well as the provincial, federal governments, who they need their help from building these kinds of units. And just open up discussion with you. What do you make of it?
I mean, obviously all social housing is great. The more the better. It's, you know, I guess it's a little bit of a drop in the bucket, like, you know, under 200 social, which for like that, for millions and millions, it would have $500 million. Was that the amount? 560 something?
No. The $500 million was, that's the budget, the city budget. For affordable social and community housing. This one is going to cost $80.5 million.
This one's going to cost $80.5 million.
$80.5 million across three projects for 191 new social affordable housing units.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a sizable, like just this project alone is then a pretty sizable chunk of the entire housing budget.
Yeah.
So I think kind of speaks to just maybe how we're not really prioritizing our housing funding properly. I mean, building housing is like very, very expensive, right? We're getting under 200 units here for, you know, $80 something million.
Yeah, that ratio is steep. It's expensive.
Yeah, it is really, just building housing in general is really expensive. So, you know, it's not a bad thing, but, you know, it could be a little bit more ambitious. I mean, that would have to come really on the part of the provincial government, unfortunately, because, again, like, they're the ones who really, they're really going to fund stuff, you know.
Yeah. We were talking about this earlier, but, like, this kind of, there's this idea, I think, that, especially from, like, politicians, I feel, where they're talking about, we have this discussion of the housing crisis. People talk about how expensive. It's multifaceted, right? Because none of these really tie to the part of the housing crisis that is like renovations. That is people the rising rents, right? None of these really tie into that. These are kind of sort of trying to create this kind of, I guess, a better net for people who are about to experience homelessness, but it doesn't quite get to the root cause of, like, the homelessness at all, right? Because over the pandemic, it's like homelessness doubled in Montreal.
Yeah.
And both of these projects, to me, are kind of examples of the city, federal government, provincial governments, wanting to build out of the housing crisis. And I'm kind of wondering what you think of that, or to what extent. Because, like, if we really want to build out the housing crisis, then you have, what is it, like, in the article, they talk about 4,500 people who are in urgent need of a roof. Mm-hmm. This seems wholly inadequate for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in terms of, like, building out of the crisis, I mean, I think it's an interesting point to bring up, because I think, like, so much of the discourse surrounding housing in, you know, in Canada and, honestly, around most of the world, really, but especially in Canada, it's, like, basically just, we need more supply, we need to build more, which is true. I mean, like, we just said, like, this probably isn't adequate to, like, meet the demand of, like, you know, over 4,000 people who need housing right now.
But it's still something.
You know, it's still something. It's not adequate. But, yeah, you know, I think this focus on exclusively just looking to build out of it is probably not enough. Like, for example, there's some language that maybe kind of worries me a little bit from the city of Montreal and from the Plante administration, especially I think they mention it in these articles about revitalizing the downtown neighborhood, revitalizing, which is like a word with a lot of baggage, obviously. You know, they kind of like have been announcing a lot of plans where they're like, we're going to clean up this neighborhood, we're going to like bring it back to its former glory and revitalize it, you know, and it's like, does that revitalization kind of just entail like getting rid of all the homeless people who like depend on this area and right. live there, and like where there's a lot of services sort of centered around there? Mm-hmm. Like it might unfortunately mean that. So I think like just building out of the housing crisis is not enough. It's like you may actually need to fundamentally change your approach to like how you're, you know, helping provide care and help to, you know, homeless communities and low income people, you know. And social housing is great, and I think there's plans to build about 500 new transitional and housing geared towards specifically homeless people, mm-hmm. And that's great, but, you know, not really sufficient.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think they talk a lot about the kind of, like, she's talking about the headache, right, of, like, trying to get the municipal, provincial, and federal governments all on the same page on this. And it's like, with like, if you have one that's sort of like open to it, but then another that's not, then you're sort of at like a stalemate, right?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting you talk about the revitalization thing, because I've been seeing this, like, when you see with the news where they're talking a lot about like trying to revitalize downtown, you know, because mostly because of like COVID, because people just like left the downtown area. It's something like 30%, I believe, of like Montreal offices are just vacant.
Oh, yeah, probably more, I think.
Yeah, so that clearly affects, like, a ton of, like, businesses around the area. And I guess, like, this is one angle of that where they're trying to get just new business happening, and I guess homeless people off the streets and into these units, right?
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's like, who is this revitalization for? Is it for businesses? Is it for people who are there? Is it for people who are in the area, you know?
Yeah, generally revitalizing means like, you know, it's something's been lost. They view, oh, something has been lost in this area and we need to bring it back. But like, there's a bunch of people who like really depend on this area and live in it and rely on it, and that's not to say that the situation in parts of, you know, downtown Montreal is great, you know, and that it's not to say that there isn't conflict happening between maybe business owners and unhoused people and whatever. Because I have read stories very recently of like there's cafes and restaurants where like we don't, you know, they're fed up with the situation and whatever.
I guess so, this is the Plante administration trying to attend to the
trying to
the business associations of Montreal, the restaurant owners.
Yeah, for sure, in some way. And also, something that's really interesting that I'm, you know, when I first read it, I was like, "This is awesome! This is sick! I can't wait for this." Which is that they want to create a 24-hour nightlife district.
Yes,
did you read about this?
So they want to
basically change laws to allow people to, you know, drink 24 hours a day, I guess. You know, awesome. But then I found out that it's actually going to be...
You endorse that?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I found out it's going to be centered in this neighborhood we're talking about. In which case, I don't know if I can endorse that. Just because it's like they're basically taking an area that they want to revitalize and going, you know, what we can do is like, you know, like you say, like there's maybe not a whole lot of like private light, like, you know, offices are empty and businesses are now kind of, they're saying they want to leave. I don't know how, if that's actually like a widespread trend or whatever. It's maybe just a couple vocal businesses. But the city's going, it wouldn't be like a great place to do that. Let's just go to this place where there's a lot of like vulnerable people living and, you know, low.
Whoa.
Wow, that's crazy.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, man. Low value. Let us know in the comment section. You know, get back to us on that. A lot of like, you know, lower value properties or businesses or whatever, and go in. Let's just open the gate for like a bunch of trendy new bars and restaurants and whatever. You know,
it's going to be interesting because it's like you're talking about. It's going to be a zone that's going to, it's going to be zoned off. That like it's a Quartier des Spectacles downtown area. It's going to be, the bars there are going to be allowed. I think they apply for licenses to be open 24 hours.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it's like, while like if you're in another part of town and like the bar is closed and people still want to party, then like you have this like whatever, like at 11 p.m. at 3 a.m. rather, this kind of like big shuffling that might happen, big conversions.
Yeah, which in some sense is like, you know, yeah, like, in theory, like, that's awesome. Because, like, I feel like it's a big thing people in Montreal have kind of been complaining about. It's, like, the nightlife has been, like, you know, even just in, like, the almost decade that I've been living here, it's, like, the, especially since COVID, the nightlife has definitely declined. And so as someone, like, living here, I'm like, yeah, like, that's awesome. Like, I'd love to have a place I could go at, like, 5 in the morning if I just am out that late for whatever reason,
I mean, the after-hours clubs here are popular, but, I mean, this kind of, like, makes it, it opens the door for, like, just more of that. And I mean, it opens the door specifically for people to continue drinking.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's probably good for, like, tourism and nightlife and the economy and whatever.
No, but, we always get a bunch of tourists from, like, the States, Ontario. Like, people celebrating their 18th birthday, they want to come here. Like, we had Kylie Jenner come to Montreal, right? You remember that?
Yeah, she was on the show. Yeah.
She was on
the show. Yeah, one of your all-time best guests.
Thank you.
Really thoughtful. Really thoughtful opinions on the housing crisis.
That's crazy. That's locked for our Patreon subscribers. We don't have a Patreon, by the way. She was not on the show. Wait, now we have to get her on the show.
Yeah. I'll have my people talk to her people. We'll figure it out.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
I know a guy.
I already know what I would ask her about. Yeah. I'd be like, so like, how'd you like beach club?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because apparently she went up to beach club. Like,
did
like,
she?
Yeah.
And she, what was she like? She was just hanging out?
No, apparently like it was her party was going to be at beach club. That's like so
her,
far.
Her party? Like,
it was an 18th, it was like a public 18th birthday party she was having at beach club.
Oh, she came to Montreal for that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Okay, that's cool.
I'm not messing around when I say
No, I mean, I know people do that. Like, I feel like you go to St. Laurent and it's like half the street is just like, you know, bachelorette parties and, you know, 18-year-olds puking everywhere. So.
Yeah.
She's an awesome vibe.
Definitely not only 18-year-olds.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but no, she came here and she went up to like beach club. She has like, it was going to be a big party, and apparently she never went there.
Oh yeah.
Like it was going to be the Kylie Jenner like birthday party, and she had booked it, but apparently she just stayed in like old Montreal.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, I was there waiting. Like, I can't say I was disappointed.
Yeah, with your like foam finger number one fan, she never showed up. That was been like really disappointing.
I'm like,
that's so
sad. Should have been
here. Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the news.
Yeah.
We got another article. Let's go. There it is. This one's in the Gazette. This one's by the Canadian Press. Montreal home prices rose in December, even as sales fell 4%.
Yeah.
In the article, it continues to say the Quebec Professional Association of Real Estate Brokers says Montreal area home sales in December fell 4% compound with the same month a year earlier. The median price of a single family home in December was $535,000, up 5% from $510,000 a year earlier, while the median price for a condominium was $391,000, up 4% from $275,000 the year prior. Then they continue on to talk about other prices going up, but sales falling.
Yeah.
So why the hell are sales falling and prices going up? That doesn't seem like the market's doing what it should be doing, Gavin.
But are you telling me?
I am.
No, I'm joking. I know why. I researched this. That's my job,
you know? It's like I did prep for the episode.
Yeah, I know what I'm talking about. No, I think it's an interesting example. Because we kind of talked a little bit earlier about how like this sort of supply, like building ourselves out of the market. Mm-hmm. Building ourselves out of the housing crisis, rather. And this is a really good example about like why supply and demand in the traditional sense don't necessarily apply to the housing market in the same way. And there's a lot of reasons, but this is the perfect example. It's like, okay, well, sales are like technically falling. Mm-hmm. So you'd think that, well, okay, there's like less demand, therefore the prices would adjust accordingly. But the people who are actually, you know, even though if sales overall have actually fallen, That doesn't mean that, like, sales among, like, wealthy investors have actually fallen, and that there's, like, an, you know, extra strong demand from these people who have so much money that, like, they don't care what the price of housing is, you know? It's kind of like the difficulty with these, like, vacancy taxes and stuff like that, and a lot of measures that are aimed to address housing. You have a question you'd like to ask?
Thank you for picking up on that.
Yeah.
Talk about, explain the vacancy tax real quick.
So yeah, vacancy tax is basically, it's a tax on housing. They're doing it in Vancouver, and, you know, they're trying to apply it in other jurisdictions.
Van City.
Not, I would not say famous for their affordable housing success, but...
Quite the opposite.
And this would probably be an example of one of those cases where, yeah, I mean, it's great, brings in money, but... the vacancy tax is basically they put a tax on empty units so that it, you know, it's supposed to dissuade investors from buying properties, you know, because like if you put like a 1% tax on their empty property, but it's like, it's not really going to dissuade them, partially because they have so much money in the first place, they don't care about paying this tax.
Sure.
And secondly, because the price
it's
of their
the cost
housing
of doing business.
Well, yeah, it's the cost of doing business, and the price of their housing is going up exponentially. It's just going crazy. So it's like, yeah,
they're still in the green.
Yeah, they pay a little bit out of pocket, but then when they flip their house in a couple of years, sometimes it's like within a year, they flip their house or 2 years, and they still make way more money back. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a similar case, like a similar dynamics happening here where it's like, you know, it doesn't matter that, like, you know, maybe there are things in the market that are dissuading regular people from buying houses. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, Mr. Moneybags, you know, obviously you know, you got millions and millions of dollars, like, you don't care. You don't care that the price of housing is going up and dissuading other regular people. Mm-hmm. You're just going, well, whatever, I'm just throwing money left and right.
Yeah.
Buying a bunch of investment properties, right?
Sure. So it's sort of like the, like, let's say, like, the people selling these homes, the prices are going up, and they're just sort of like patiently waiting for these wealthy people to be buying the homes.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much what's going on. I mean, I guess there are less home sales, so they're not all, obviously they're not all being bought by these wealthy investors, but it's the, that's what's really like, I guess the point is really that that is what drives sort of the housing inflation going on. It's a very, it can be a very small, select sort of investor class that disproportionately is like spending money to, you know, up the price of housing and whatever, right?
Sure. So it's not like, yeah, it's not like, I guess the picture some people have in their head is like, oh, like families going around like, oh, let's buy some houses. But like, I guess you're painting a picture of like, you have these people who are putting these houses on the market. They're not being sold,
yeah.
But they're still like, as more, I guess it speaks more to the expectation, right, of these people selling the houses that like,
yeah,
they can still get these prices, or they just have to be, it's something like they're really after the price more than like after like the sale, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It's partially that, and then it's also just a matter of kind of understanding the housing market as like, you know, we talk about the housing market as one market, like it, the housing market, and that like, you know, supply and demand is going to work in the same way across the market, and that's not really the case. And in fact, there's actually a lot of different sub-markets. Like, there's a lot of different markets and a lot of different buyers with different needs and intentions.
Sure.
Throughout the housing market.
A whole ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a whole ecosystem. It's a good way of putting it. And you know, there can be particular subsections that, you know, have completely different needs or interests or demands, mm-hmm, than, you know, like somebody who, you know, is a multi-millionaire real estate investor with a bunch of, you know, this guy.
Money,
right? Talking about this
big
guy over
money
here.
Is there a green screen behind me? That'd be great if we could get it.
I think there is a green screen behind you. But, yeah, you know, that's totally different than somebody, like, the needs of somebody like us, like regular, well, not you, obviously, you're wealthy, wealthy beyond belief, but regular people like me and the rest of the crew here
who are
working day in and day out to, you know,
definitely not
subsidize this little venture of yours.
I appreciate all your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for that description of the market, and I guess the strange things that seem to happen in the market that make the news. I feel like tons of people our age are sort of waiting for the crash.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, hope the market crashes so we can finally afford a home. But
yeah.
Who knows when it's going to come.
Yeah, and I mean, Montreal has it pretty easy, too, compared to, you know, like, I mean, the average home price is, you know, in the 500,000 range.
Yeah.
And Vancouver is like 1.3 million. And like we're feeling the crunch here, and then it's like I can't even imagine like living
in Gavin, could I borrow 1.3 million?
Yeah, sure, man. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, totally.
I'm going to Vancouver.
Yeah, cool.
How much is it in Toronto, do you know?
About 1.1 million, I think, yeah. But, you know, I mean, the estimates kind of vary depending on who you go to and who you ask. But, yeah, it's about a ballpark.
Yeah, I feel like the variance is still, like, in the range of, like, unaffordable to us.
It's all, like, unaffordable. Yeah, yeah, that's the thing, for sure.
It moves a few, like, decimal points. I'm like, cool, I can still not afford it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, it's like the affordable housing thing. It's like, oh, it's affordable housing, legally designated affordable housing. It's like, okay, well, yeah, but the house is, like, $1.3 million in Vancouver. It doesn't really matter to me if it's, you know, 1.1 million in Vancouver or 1 million in Vancouver. You know, the threshold is just, like, it's too high. Like, the barrier to entry is, like, crazy.
Here's an idea for affordable rent.
Yeah.
I'm walking around. I find a cool rock on the street. I give that to my landlord. Month rent.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's that been working out for you?
It hasn't been.
Yeah. Evicted.
Immediately.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, you're 4 months late on rent? I'm like, did you get my four rocks? Let's go to the next article. The next article is, I guess, more about gentrification, development, new annoying neighbors, as some would say. So here we have a nice picture of Sergio Da Silva, owner, proprietor of Turbo House, Montreal punk venue. The title is called Turbo House and the Flight for the Soul and the Fight for the Soul of Montreal's Cultural Scene. This is published in The Rover. Turbo House, punk venue. You ever go to shows there?
Oh, a bunch of times, yeah. No, I love Turbo House.
Super fun.
But they've changed locations a few times, right?
Three times. So their first location was on Saint Antoine in the building that was right behind the Bell Center.
Yep.
That building got demolished. There's a bunch of jam spaces. I mean, that it's interesting because that whole building was, like, sort of derelict.
Yeah.
But it was kind of perfect for, like, people who want to have jam sessions. There's, like, little venues in there.
Yeah.
I think the Turbo House was, like, right next to it or a part of the building, I'm unsure. I never went to the first iteration. But I've been to the second iteration. So once that building was demolished, people moved out. Turbo House went to St. Henry. They're on, I think it was, like, actually, I'm not gonna tell you which corner it was because I can't quite remember. But it was kind of, like, deeper in St. Henry.
Yeah.
Further from the metro. They got into issues there. I think Sergio talks about in the article.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
Where he talks about, like, it's a bit more of a residential area.
Yeah.
So you would have all these punks coming to these shows, and then neighbors would be complaining about people having sex in their yards because they're like the punks who went to the show. And they would complain to Sergio about it. Hilarious.
Yeah, it is really fun. It's awesome.
Hilarious. It's like, dude, you party too hard. Anyway, so now they are much more downtown, much more in the central location.
Yeah.
Again, not too far from these the 191 affordable units we were talking about before they're being built. Now they're like right in between. They're on Saint Denis, right between Sherbrooke and Ontario. Nice central location. Yeah. They've been there for like a decent amount of time, pretty settled.
Yeah.
But here's the thing is, they live in a nice location now.
Yeah.
They're getting noise complaints.
Yes, they are.
People are complaining about the noise. So when Sergio came in and they set up Turbo House there, there was an empty lot behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the course of the pandemic, there's a condo building right behind them.
Yeah.
Big, brand new development. And the people in that condo building, some of them are complaining about the noise.
Yeah.
So someone put in a noise complaint with the city, and now I'm going to read this email that Sergio got. I think it's also the next slide. Oh, it's not. Let's go back. So the email reads, please take note that legal persons who contravene these regulations are liable to a fine of $1,500 to $12,000, reads the email that Sergio published on Instagram. So that was about the noise. So like $1,500 to $12,000 for noise violation from his establishment. And the journalist with the Rover asks Sergio, what would a $12,000 fine mean for him and his establishment? And Sergio says, oh, F that. It's finished, he says. You know, that's almost all my sales for a week. That's payroll, that's my salary, that's everything. It's just gone. Because why? Because one person is unhappy.
Yeah.
So I guess this ties into a bit about what we're talking about with, like, you know, here the city is committed to, like, revitalizing this kind of downtown area. You have this talk about, like, how it's important for Montreal to be, like, this cultural, Montreal is the cultural capital of Canada, right? But then with rising rents, with the inaffordability of life here, and then especially with people complaining about noise from a cultural establishment, when they moved into this kind of cultural area, it seems kind of I don't know if ironic is the word, but there's something there. I was kind of curious. What do you make of this story, Gavin?
Yeah, I mean, just a classic case of people getting evicted because they're too cool. I mean, yeah. I worry about that every day personally. Yeah. But
the cool police are here.
Oh God, not again. Oh man, every week.
He smoked too tough.
Yeah, no, it's definitely unfortunate. I mean, I think it's sort of, before I get into sort of some of the analysis of it, I will say that, you know, we mentioned this whole nightlife kind of plan that the city's doing, and I do think one thing that is really great in that plan that, I mean, I don't know if it'll actually be implemented, but one thing they said they would like to do is address, you know, issues like this, the noise complaint stuff, because this isn't the first case, of this happening. I know the Divan Orange... I believe it was, R.I.P., man. Pour one out. I have no water in my coat.
So worried there.
I remember I loved that venue, and I might be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure a similar thing happened where, like, some person moved upstairs, which I don't know why you move, like, upstairs above, like, an awesome music venue, and then you, like, called so many noise complaints that they got shut down, went out of business. So... in that sense, like, definitely tightening the laws around the noise complaint thing would really help cases like this. It's also just a really clear example of, like, you know, some of the issues and the conflicts that arise when areas begin to redevelop and become gentrified. Like, you know, obviously there's site in St. Henry, which is like a rapidly gentrifying area.
Oh, yeah.
And has been for a long time, right? And you are going to have a lot of, like, you know, more like middle income people kind of coming into, or like upper income, trying to move into this trendy new area, and they want peace and quiet, and they're not always going to be friendly to like the existing sort of fabric of the community.
Sure, yeah.
And so this does unfortunately happen. It's like you have these sort of conflicting uses and interests. And especially in the case, I think it's really a good example of, you know, a brand new development goes up and they don't have any problems until suddenly a new resident in this new, market rate housing out back decides that, you know, they don't like the noise coming. It's just not really fair, right?
Yeah.
So
maybe it says something about the people who can afford housing right now.
Yeah.
Afford buying a downtown unit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like they sort of want the suburban quiet life, but then they still want to be somewhere central, and it's like you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, it's like they want, it's kind of like, yeah, it's an interesting dynamic for sure when you put it that way, because it's like they want, like, yeah, they want to have, like, the walkability and the trendiness of these neighborhoods, and when they go there, like, the people who actually, like, live there or are doing things are just, like, not palatable to them, so they're this isn't, like, you know, their vision or idea of this, like, what this neighborhood should be is not that, you know, all these people who already live here are having fun and partying and drinking and having sex in people's backyards. I guess you probably shouldn't. I shouldn't technically formally endorse that. You know, I guess it's technically against the law. You know, so but you know,
don't do that.
Don't do that.
You do not do that. And when people stop you, don't say you got the idea from us. Okay?
Yeah, please. So, anyways. I do think there's another really interesting conversation to have here, though. Mm-hmm. When I was reading the article, it definitely had me thinking a lot about, rent control, but, you know, specifically in Canada and Quebec. I mean, I think pretty much in all of North America, we don't actually have commercial rent control. We only have rent control for residential units, and obviously that rent control is not. It could be a lot stronger. Mm-hmm. You know, this is obviously a slightly different case. Obviously, people are just, like, calling noise complaints, and that's sort of different. Kind of still talking about that theme of, like, gentrification and stuff like that, sometimes it's not always noise complaints that kick important community spaces and businesses out of these gentrifying neighborhoods. A lot of the time, it's just the rent goes up, you know, the property value increases, and, like, a lot of the time it's not noise complaints. It's just we can't afford our rent. You have companies like Schiller Lavey, who recently changed their name, by the way. I don't know if you remember Schiller Lavey.
Of course. They're instrumental in essentially buying up, like, they always do this. So they have a bunch of properties in the old port. They kind of gentrified Mount Royal Street by buying a bunch of properties there. They rented out to, like, Slice and Soda, Avenue. They did Mount Royal Street. They did Notre Dame in St. Henry. And then over the last few years, they've been doing St. Viateur in the Mile End.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, basically their business strategy is they, they come into a neighborhood that's already, you know, might not always be low income, but is definitely maybe has not reached its maximum value potential or whatever. Like, they come in, they go, you know, we think we could take this family business, buy the building, kick them out, and put in, like, you know, they basically put in these trendy, like, Instagrammable kind of, like, you know, restaurants and bars or whatever, you know, like Slice and Soda, and it's like, it's awesome. They have a pinball machine, and there's Baby Yoda on the wall, and there's like a neon sign that says, touch my butt and feed me pizza, or whatever. And you're like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's super like, kind of like sterile, like just kind of nothing culture.
It's just it just feels very like unlived in and very like a bit alien to the neighborhood.
So, and also, you know, so manicured, I find, those kinds of places, right?
Yeah.
It's like when you go into like La Belle La Beurve and you're in the bathroom and there's just like fake graffiti everywhere, and it's like, oh, like, what is this?
Yeah, I saw a TikTok if it was like some woman with like a fancy ass giant mansion house, and the whole place was like super like prim and proper and like really nice, but then she was like, I built like a punk bathroom like in my mansion, and it was like,
I'm calling
and
I had my,
yeah,
I'm taking the shit there and calling it Rooster Place.
Oh man, yeah, anyways, it's like that type of vibe, although it's like as easy as it is to get like caught up in the aesthetics of it, which I do think is like a sort of valid critique. Yes, the aesthetics and whatever are more indicative of like something else that's kind of more pernicious that's happening, which is like
a broader kind of thing.
Which is like, you know, it's not that the place is just inauthentic, but it's just like they're, you know, the authenticity that used to be there was associated with these places that were like family owned businesses and like staples that were important to the community, and like now you kind of go there and you're like, this feels like placeless, like this is nothing. What is this?
The show, right? It's like a pure like
Just
like a fabrication.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really sad for, you know, like, you know, it can be a small, like, immigrant-owned business, for example, or it could be a community space or, like, a nonprofit space or something.
Where these places aren't rent-protected.
They're not rent-protected, yeah. And so it's important to mention that because if you live in a unit, like a residential unit in Quebec and in a lot of provinces in Canada, they could, you know, your landlord can only raise your rent a certain percentage every year, right? You know, 2 to 3%. The provincial government will like set out a mandate or whatever and go, yeah, you can raise it up to 3%. Commercial, you can raise it anything you want. There are no protections. So, you know, you could be like
triple the rent.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that happened. That's what Schiller Lavie would do. I mean, that's why it was important to mention them, because what they did is in Mile End, and they would come in and they would buy, you know, like a family-owned bakery or something that's, like, been in the area for 20-plus years, 30-plus years, or, like, whatever, long-time businesses and spaces that are important for certain communities, and they'd buy it, and they'd literally quadruple the rent overnight, and then immediately it's like, well, this person's like, well, I'm just completely, like, out of money. Like, I'm bankrupt.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to add to that point, it's like, I guess without these rent protections, because I mean, I think rent protection does apply to this Turbiles case, because like he's talking about like a $12,000 fine on top of other costs, right? Yeah. And a lot of times these kind of like cultural venues, they're not making too much money, right?
No, unless, not at all.
Unless you're like a metropolis, unless you're like one of these big ones, and already these are owned by like people who already have money. Yeah. Like these smaller venues, they're sort of just kind of like cutting it close, right?
Yeah.
So without rent protection, a $12,000 fine, any fine is such a huge chunk of their like operating budget, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess if Sergio and Turbiles got that fine, but then they had rent protections, maybe that's just a stronger kind of like base for them to stand on, to operate from, makes it a little more secure to be kind of a cultural institution establishment in Montreal.
Yeah.
But you're telling me businesses don't have that.
Businesses don't have that. And I mean, in this case, I mean, a lot of the time with sort of important venues like this, they do, not all the time, but they do, you know, manage to find landlords that are maybe sympathetic. Or, you know, there can be venues where they own the building themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with, you know, a lot of different places, like I think like Casa de Popolo and some of these other like big venues, I think own the buildings themselves. I'm not 100% sure. And so that's great. But for people like this who don't and they just need a space, it's like, I mean, it sounds like maybe they have a decent landlord who's not raising the rent $1,000 every month. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like not great for like that uncertainty. It's not,
course,
you know, it's not good for the community.
Precarious.
It is very precarious.
Our cultural institutions are in a state of precarity.
Yeah, not good.
I think, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, not really. Yeah, get me out of here.
Really? No. All right. Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning into the main segment of Metropolis, our January 17th episode. This was Gavin Armitage Ackerman. Do you want to plug in socials? What are you working on right now?
What am I working on right now?
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, it's fine. I didn't really come up with anything for the show, but yeah, I mean, I write articles periodically for Canadian Dimension on housing, so you can read some of my articles there, and I'm always interested to hear feedback. Sometimes I hear from people who read them, and it's all kind of cool. So I write there. Other than that, I don't know what I'm working on. I'll be honest. I don't know what I'm doing.
Where am I?
I gotta get out of here.
All right, tune in, folks. We'll be back with Hello Goodbye Lines. See you soon in 10 minutes. Welcome back to Metropolis. I'm your host, Colin Datsipa. Today, we're back to Hello Goodbye Lines, our segment where we check in with our journalists at CUTV and see what they've been reporting on. Today, Savannah Craig joins us again. How are you, Savannah?
I'm doing well, Colin. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
All right. What do you have for us on the first Hello Goodbye Lines of 2024?
Yes, I'm here to talk about press freedoms, or rather the lack of press freedoms, amidst a massive killing of journalists in Gaza, and how this is a threat to press freedoms internationally.
Okay.
So I reached out throughout the last week. I reached out to Montreal-based journalists to hear their thoughts on what's happening in Gaza, what's happening specifically to journalists, and if they think that this is a threat to press freedoms. But before I get into that, I want to speak about a vigil that I attended last week. This was hosted by Palestinian Youth Movement, and it was a vigil. It was a vigil to commemorate the lives lost of journalists in Gaza. We could check out some visuals from that.
Palestinian journalists offer a window into a world that is otherwise isolated from us, both metaphorically and literally isolated from us. So we can understand why, then, Israel deliberately targets these journalists. Their existence and their stories shake the very foundation of the Zionist narrative.
We want justice for the journalists that have been killed in Gaza. We will honor our martyrs. Repeat after me, please. Mohammed Abu Dair.
Mohammed Abu Dair.
Abdullah Baris.
Abdullah Baris.
Rami El-Sharafi.
Rami El-Sharafi.
Hamza El-Dahdouh.
Hamza El-Dahdouh.
Mustafa Turaya.
Mustafa Turaya.
Akram El-Shafi.
Akram El-Shafi.
Jabir Abu Hadrous.
Jabir Abu Hadrous.
Ahmed Khairuddin.
Ahmed Khairuddin.
I think the journalists in Gaza are the most courageous people that I have ever seen. They are documenting their own genocide, they're documenting the pain and suffering of their people, and without them, we as a society who believe that we are in a democratic society, we need them. We need them to document and tell the story in a way that people will listen. We need them to tell the story in a way that future generations will say, look what happened.
Mohammed Khairuddin.
Mohammed Khairuddin.
Hudayfa Lulu.
Hudayfa Lulu.
Mohammed Al-Ghuf.
Mohammed Al-Ghuf.
Mohammed Saadi.
Mohammed Saadi.
Ahmed Jamal Madhoun.
Ahmed Jamal Madhoun.
Mohammed Nasser Abu Haydi.
Mohammed Nasser Abu Haydi.
Abdullah Alwan. Muhammad Azaytuniya.
We know that journalists have always been targeted because they represent a threat to the Zionist entity, which is that they dare report on the truth. And when their truth is able to get to the world, is able to reach the four corners of the world, this threat is even bigger for them because it shakes the very foundation of the Zionist state.
Incredibly powerful words from the vigil. There's some text on the screen that was passing by that was describing, this is for audio listeners, but there's some text on the screen that was passing by and describing, I guess, the some specific incidents of these journalists being killed and things that are happening to them and their families.
Mm-hmm.
So strong words from the Palestinian Youth Movement organized vigil. makes me think about the importance of journalism, the importance of press freedom, to be able to give a critical eye to the powers that be, let's say, to our governments, other bodies, other civic bodies, and kind of not take what they're saying for granted and try to examine it, analyze it. And I guess what they're trying to say is that the target of these journalists is clearly intentional and trying to dissuade this critical eye that's being put on the Israeli government for their actions in Gaza and also the West Bank and also other parts of Israel.
The speakers at this event, they took a lot of time to, you know, focus on how they believe that Israel is deliberately targeting journalists currently in Gaza, but, you know, that there's a history of journalists in Palestine being targeted. And they also really, I think, tried to humanize these journalists, you know, not just specifically speak about their work, but speak about the ongoing trauma that they're experiencing. While Al-Dadu, he's a Al Jazeera Gaza bureau chief, his name came up a lot at this vigil, especially as at the end of October, his wife, his 7-year-old daughter, and 15-year-old son were killed in an Israeli airstrike, and he returned to work the next day. And most recently this month, on January 7th, his 27-year-old son, Hamza, who was also an Al Jazeera journalist, was killed, and also returned to work the next day. So they really tried to, you know, shed light on this and show that despite all the horrific things that journalists are experiencing in their personal life amidst, you know, trying to stay safe during this war, you know, they are continuing to persevere and report.
Incredible. Such incredible courage. I think it was Ellen Gabriel who was saying that.
There were many Palestinian youth movement organizers who I highlighted in this video here, but as you brought up Ellen Gabriel, she's not only been at this vigil, but she's attended various pro-Palestinian demonstrations to speak. She is a Mohawk activist and a filmmaker.
Yes, I think she rose to public attention during the Oka crisis. She was one of the strongest voices speaking on behalf of the Kanye.
I wanted to highlight a quote, if we could actually pull it up on screen. It's from Wael Al-Dadu following the death of his son a couple weeks ago. 107 journalists fell and their blood was shed on this land as if nobody heard of this news and nobody saw what was happening. I really wanted to emphasize and focus on this statement during this segment because, you know, he's pointing out the mass death and mass, you know, lack of reaction as if no one saw these deaths. But we are. We're seeing these deaths in 4K. You know, we're hearing what's going on in Gaza. And I think that anyone, unless you're kind of living under a rock, you generally know what's going on. And what's happening in Gaza is horrific on all fronts. You know, thousands of civilians are being killed. They're being displaced or injured. You know, most of the hospitals aren't functioning or are either partially functioning, as Israel is targeting hospitals. As they say, they're being used by Hamas for either storing fuel for warfare or having tunnels underneath them. You know, no proof has come out that hasn't been discredited. More than 100 journalists have died. And I spent the last week, as I said earlier, reaching out to journalists and organizations that represent journalists in Montreal to try and understand if they think that the mass killing of journalists in Gaza is a threat to press freedoms. Most of them didn't respond to me.
that's usually what the case is.
Unfortunately. But I think that did say something to me because I think I've just been so shocked with the lack of reaction from journalists, you know, lack of unification from journalists. I think that, you know, I am seeing shock online and people really communicate how shocked and upset they are. But I'm not seeing action. You know, where is the reaction from the international community of journalists? There's no call for, or minimal calls for, the threat against the profession itself, the profession of journalism. No greater alliance among journalists, or, you know, unification to call for a ceasefire or accountability of journalists being killed. And I think that this, I'm shocked and disappointed in the profession.
It's sort of happening, but you don't see any kind of like calls to action to protect journalists, or any, you really feel like the response has been almost like nil and like kind of disproportionate to the violence that journalists are experiencing.
Mm-hmm. I think there's been, you know, great kind of takes, columns, things like this, but I am just very, I think, shocked and disappointed that, you know, more journalists haven't come together to, because I think we do have power in our voice. We have power in our words that are published or said on TV. But, you know, I think that there could be some greater good that comes from a unification of journalists, but I'm just not seeing this happen.
Mm-hmm. What kind of responses did you get from these Montreal-based journalists?
Yeah. You're racing me forward in my segment.
Oops.
I'll give you a little tidbit.
Give me a little tease.
Sure. Someone really great I spoke with. She's a writer and freelance journalist. Her name is Lital Haikin. I'll just read out a quote she said, and if you want to share some thoughts, please go ahead.
Sure.
So essentially, the same. I asked these journalists various different questions, but the leading question that I had was, do you think that the mass killing of journalists in Gaza is a threat to international press freedoms? She said to me, one of the first indicators of fascism is the designation of worthy and unworthy victims. By the time those who are deemed unworthy include journalists, fascism has long since ceased to be a threat and has become a fully fledged reality. As Israel continues to slaughter civilians and journalists with impunity since it began its bombardment on Gaza on October 7th, journalists around the world bear witness to this progression on a mass scale.
Okay. So I guess that's not mincing words. Seems to be insinuating the Israeli government has fascist leanings, given that they are targeting these journalists. And I guess it's something like it's something that makes me think of, like, you know the, like, the idiom of a canary in a coal mine.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, absolutely.
So it's like the canary in the coal mine, right? If this dies, that tells the miners that, like, oxygen has run out, oxygen is starting to run out, and this canary is kind of like the first to go. Or in this case, it's like journalists. So I guess some people might think of, like, oh, if they're targeting journalists now, that means, like, it's like they're about to be fascists. Where I think she's saying, like, no, if journalists are gone, then that's like, it's like the ship has sailed, the canary is long dead, and that, like, the risk is like has been made like incredibly real. It's no longer, I guess it's no longer a risk, but it's like now like the reality, right? This fascist reality is what she seems to be insinuating, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I necessarily disagree, because it is a very concerning thing when you have something that's supposed to be this institution that holds truth to power kind of being completely decimated, right? Not just the institution, of course, but like the people doing the reporting, right? It's like Wael's whole family, like, incredibly, like, just disappeared. It's incredibly tragic and incredibly concerning as well.
Mm-hmm. I think kind of the lack of reaction is also interesting, too, given the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. He was killed on October 7th, 2018. You know, suspected to be by the Saudi, or ordered by the Saudi prince Mohammed bin Salman, who was at the time implementing a zero tolerance crackdown on dissent on social media. Just for a little bit more context, Khashoggi was a journalist and columnist for the Washington Post and the Middle East Eye. For months, for like a very long time after his assassination, you know, U.S. media institutions, democracy organizations, and press freedom groups, you know, were strongly denouncing his killing and, you know, questioning how this is a threat to press freedoms. And, you know, even organizations such as Freedom House, the Human Rights Foundation, they were both extremely vocal then. But at this time, we're hearing little reaction from organizations such as these and other organizations that supposedly stand for press freedoms.
That's interesting. So you have that, the case of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist. his death was, like, I guess, singular, right? So it's, like, I guess maybe, like, people... It's singular also in a time, I feel like, of kind of, like... Not of, like, quiet or slow news, but, like, there was... I feel like there's not enough going on that, like, that case was really able to, like, shine in. Like, it's full, all the nuances there.
Mm-hmm.
Where maybe, with, like, the issue happening right now in Palestine is that it's just this... So many journalists are dying, and people just don't know what to make of it. I mean, this has been, like, a last few months of, like, just, like historical events, right? And there's such a deluge of these kinds of events that people aren't fully processing all the little nuances, which is, I think, what your reporting is at least starting to attempt to do, right? To wade through this mess of, like, trauma and try to pinpoint this kind of issue of, like, journalists dying. It's like, we haven't responded to this with the same proportionality that people were responding to the Jamal Khashoggi assassination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I strongly believe, and it's something that really came up in all the journalists who, you know, responded to my email and agreed to speak with me, is that, you know, any threat to any journalist is a threat to all of us. And, you know, discrediting of any work that a journalist is doing to share the truth, such as what's going on with journalists in Gaza, is a threat to the truth itself. And I think, I hope that many people know this, but I would like to remind people that, you know, the targeting of journalists is a war crime, and we're not seeing international law protecting journalists or providing accountability for the journalists that are being killed. Do you want to hear some more testimonies?
Let's hear it.
I'll go back to Lital. She shared with me that the Committee to Protect Journalists, also known as the CPJ, reported that in the months following October 7th, it's marked the deadliest period for journalists since 1992, which is the year that they began collecting data. I quote her, "In deliberately targeting journalists and building housing and buildings housing press outlets, Israel is has blatantly violated international law, failing to comply with the UN Security Council Resolution 2222 on the protection of journalists in armed conflict. The International Criminal Court is leading an investigation into Israeli crimes against journalists, addressing the death of over 70 Palestinian journalists since October 7th, as the CPJ continues to report multiple assassinations, threats, cyber attacks, censorships, and killings of family members."
Something I've read was that something like the more journalists have died in since October 7th in Palestine than during all of World War II.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have much. I don't know. There's, I find this kind of stuff speaks for itself. It's just so concerning. Is like a word that always kind of comes up for this kind of stuff. But it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's like without journalists. Of course, you'll have people who are like, maybe like who are like independent reporters, right? People just, there's this kind of natural thing of like participatory media where people record stuff and kind of like, in a certain kind of way, report it on it themselves from their phones, right? But it doesn't have the institutional kind of support that journalists do, right? Where they
mm-hmm.
can record something, speak on something, but then they also have the channels to make sure that that is like broadcast to like a wide audience. They don't have the channel of like the process, let's say, of like editors who get to look at it, get to fact check, get to like really like refine it into like a piece that's like accessible, easily digestible, and I guess like just like the hard facts straight.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. It's incredibly concerning. I don't know. I'm going to be saying that a lot today, it feels.
What you said is something that came up in my interview with Una Barrette. She's a journalist at Pivot. She had essentially discussed, you know, citizen journalism, and what she said to me, you know, amidst the mass killing of journalists, mass death of journalists, you know, she said that's why there's a real citizen journalism initiative. And the info being shared is more visual and written. It's because all they've got left is to convey information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, what you just said about, you know, the citizen journalism, even Motaz Azeza, he's not employed with an outlet. I forget his exact role, but it is like a body within the UN.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like he's kind of adjusted his role since the bombardment started and just like really been documented and you know.
Who is he?
He is very popular online. I'm like, can we pull up a photo lesson? Motaz. I'm gonna look up his role.
Sure.
You'll know it when you see his face. He's a photojournalist and he is employed. Who is he employed with? the UNRWA. Essentially like a nonprofit showing Palestinian refugees that Americans care.
Okay, sure.
I mean, I encourage you all to Google him at home, but does this image help?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I think he's gone viral a few times.
Yeah, very many times, and his images. There's like you have to be ready when you go watch his stories. Mm-hmm. Like I've seen probably the most horrific images coming out of Gaza are ones that he's published, which I think is absolutely important because I think it motivates people to do something and also realize how horrific. What's going on?
Sure.
I think he's not a citizen journalist. He's a photographer, but I think it has been interesting to kind of see, you know, the kind of surge in citizen journalism because, you know, Gazans just want people to see what's going on and they want people to act on it.
Of course, and they have the tools at their disposal, right? They have the phones, wherever they can to broadcast information, they will.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually wanted to bring up something. I had reached out to the IDF's North America Media Desk in December after the death of another journalist, Al Jazeera journalist. His name is Samer Abu Dhaka. He was essentially, he was reporting alongside Wael and an Israeli airstrike occurred and Samara was trapped under the rubble. Mm-hmm. Al Jazeera said that Israeli forces prevented aid from reaching him and he was essentially left to bleed out. So at that time I reached out to the IDF for a statement on this and, you know, just kind of questioned, provided a statement from Al Jazeera, you know, asked for a comment from them and also questioned, you know, the possible targeting of journalists. What they said to me at the time is that journalists are not targeted, but they are at risk being in a war zone. I quote, "The IDF takes all operationally feasible measures to protect both civilians and journalists. The IDF has never and will never deliberately target journalists. Given the ongoing exchanges of fire, remaining in an active combat zone has inherent risks. The IDF will continue to counter threats while persisting to mitigate harm to civilians." So I know that in the specific case of Hamza Wael's son, he was hit alongside his colleague by an Israeli airstrike while they were driving the car. I know that an investigation has still yet to be carried out. But Israel has advanced technology. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen targeted strikes. I've even seen videos of, like, apartment complexes and, like, you know, a unit in the middle is specifically striked. Kind of...
I believe that's what happened in Lebanon.
It was
one of the Hamas contacts between Hamas and Iran, I think, was targeted specifically in that kind of precise way.
Mm-hmm.
So you're suggesting that they have the means to be precise.
Yeah, this is what I'm seeing. I know Israel, a lot of people are saying that, you know, Israel was responsible for this specific, the Hamas targeting in Lebanon. They've yet to, you know, kind of come out and say it was them.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, we are seeing their advanced technology being put to use, so why are journalists in cars, you know, being hit with an Israeli airstrike? Mm-hmm. You know, hospitals are being bombarded because they're saying that this is where Hamas is, you know, storing fuel. You know, Hamas is operating in these hospitals. So what's the reason for his targeting a car?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess I can share a few more things. Nital had, like, a lot of great statistics to share with me. She said that this is essentially the fourth war crime complaint filed by Reporters Without Borders with the ICC since 2018, essentially when journalists were killed by Israeli forces in the Great March of Return, which were protests in Gaza, as well as they filed complaints in airstrikes on Gaza in 2021, media outlets that were targeted at the time. I remember at that time the Al Jazeera offices in Gaza were bombed, and they were notified that they had 20 minutes to leave, and essentially Israel said, Hamas is using these offices, so we need to bomb it.
Concerning.
Yeah, I'm never here with too much uplifting information for you.
That's fine. I don't think people go to the news to be uplifted.
No. Litala, she also called out a specific organization I know I had mentioned before, kind of lack of response from, press freedom organizations. She had called out poets, essayists, and novelists, also known as Pen Canada, which is an organization entrusted with the mandate of campaigning on the behalf of writers, journalists facing political persecution, imprisonment, and exile. She said that they've not only remained silent recently on the situation in Gaza, but she said that they've remained silent for years of oppression and censorship that Palestinian writers and journalists have experienced. So there's kind of not just this moment right now, but there's this history of kind of lack of action and support for journalists in the region who are trying to expose, their realities, the realities of civilians in Gaza or the West Bank, and kind of amplify and, I guess, try and push for some international reaction or change. I quote her, this is Lital, "The lives of Palestinian journalists and the honor of the profession must be respected by calling on Israeli accountability for its war crimes and for the multi-generational state of apartheid it has imposed on Palestinians since the 1948 Nakba." I spoke with another journalist. She's a journalist at Pivo, and she also did her undergraduate in conflict studies and human rights. So she had some really interesting things to say. Her name is Leah Bolo Krachanov, and she essentially said that the mass death of journalists in Gaza is absolutely a risk to international press freedoms. And she added that the sheer fact that this is the highest death toll amongst journalists in such a little time, as you had identified before, makes her concerned for the future of press freedoms, which is essentially something that all journalists I spoke with had agreed on and shared themselves.
That it is a danger.
Yeah, it's a danger and a threat, essentially.
I'm curious, who are the institutions and journalists who did not respond?
Yeah, let me pull it up.
It could be that I don't know. There's a lot of reasons why someone might not respond, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't want to assume, why they're not responding. But I think that we're at such a pivotal moment for press freedoms, that I think personally, if I were employed at a press freedom organization, I would probably have a statement like that prepared.
Of course. Just what those organizations are supposed to be about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that one was the... I'm going to try and pull it up.
This one, yeah, go ahead.
Any thoughts that you have on kind of what's going on?
I think there's something really interesting about Lital's comments on these organizations that are supposed to represent, like, the protection of writers, journalists as well, and how she feels like they're not kind of, like, really doing what they're supposed to, right? Which is kind of interesting. It's like, if we set up these institutions, people, set up these institutions to do this kind of thing, and they're not doing it right now. I'm kind of wondering, like, what is the block? I'm kind of curious about
what these institutions, why these institutions aren't quite acting on this, or what about the deaths of journalists in Gaza to them doesn't read as something involving press freedoms, right? Because it's like there's some kind of like arithmetic that's happening where they're, of course, they're like, if they're journalists and they're at least even a little bit plugged in, right? You're like, you're saying, as long as they're not living under a rock, they're aware that there's these kind of deaths happening. But there's some calculus there where these people might be seeing this, but then they're not quite connecting the dots to, oh, this is about press freedom, right? Mm-hmm. They're just, I don't know, maybe they're buying the line from the IDF where they're talking about how they're just kind of killed in the line of duty, right? Where it's not necessarily that they're targeted, but it's just that they're in like an active war zone, an active like battle area where there's like hostile engagements, and that their deaths might just be a part of that risk that was realized rather than being targeted. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So I had reached out to a few prominent columnists. Those I had not gotten a response from in terms of the organization.
I'm wondering, like CBC, Global News, City TV, CTV.
I didn't reach out to media outlets.
Sure.
More like organizations that like support the free press. One of them was who are these guys? La Fédération Professionnelle des Journalistes du Québec.
Okay, sure.
I believe I've had communication with them in the past, but no, I had not received a response from them. And I'll keep looking for the other one that I reached out to.
But I mean, I think it's just their silence is interesting, right, on this kind of matter. Because you would think this would be like a top of desk kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I hope I didn't go to the junk email.
That sounds like it could be.
I mean, maybe I am hoping I went to the junk email.
Oh, right. That would explain the silence rather than them reading it and then just kind of like deciding it's not the right thing to write on. I'm curious. Did the journalist you did reach out to who get back? How do you feel was like a way to summate what they were saying?
Oh, they had a lot to say. Yeah. I mean, a lot of really, really great
journalists
things.
Journalists do have a lot to say.
That they do. I think, like, overall, the summary would essentially be that, you know, they called out numerous organizations that are not, that are essentially silent.
Mm-hmm.
And ones specifically that have not been silent before on other issues affecting the press. And essentially a lot of fears. And I think what I sensed in some of those interviews was anxiety as well. And I think that kind of like pushes along, you know, the statement that I had made earlier that, you know, an attack on any journalist is an attack to us all. And I think that journalists who are really concerned, you know, they feel this deeply. I think I feel this deeply. Like when I read about any journalist who's been killed in Gaza, I mean any journalist at all, but specifically at this time, any journalist that's been killed in Gaza or their family member, like it feels such a deep wound for me, because I'm like, you know, I cover stuff like this. I mean, obviously I'm not in Gaza, like my life is not under threat, but this could be any one of us. If any one of us were there, like it's not even just simply like targeting a journalist. It's trying to silence someone. And
right.
I think I have experienced silencing tactics here in Canada, which I think one of the most popular forms is, you know, online harassment, which is something I've been experiencing for the last few months over my coverage in Gaza and the movements and reactions here, as well as lawsuits. None that have like gone forward. The threat of lawsuits,
sure.
Multiple threats of lawsuits, and often people who have threatened me, you know, they work at large organizations, corporations that I'm critiquing, most often the case has been like a human rights violation complaint against them that I'm covering, and you know, obviously doing my due diligence to get their side of the story. Often they don't want to say much, but they will, you know, threaten a lawsuit or tell me, be careful in what you say. And these are all kind of silencing tactics. And I think that this is nothing surprising for any journalist who do cover, you know, not just sensitive situations, but specifically situations, you know, that critique people with massive amounts of power, you know, such as governments or such as corporations. But I think that there's kind of this scale where it's like, yeah, I'm threatened with a lawsuit, but oh my God, people are being bombed. Mm-hmm. People are being shot at. Mm-hmm.
It's a whole other level.
Yeah, they're trapped under the rubble, prevented from aid reaching them. And their families are being targeted. Mm-hmm. I think that that's such a deep wound because I think so many journalists, they understand what they're getting into when they do this job. You know, I'm a target. I could be harassed online. I could experience a lawsuit. I could be killed. I could be tortured. Mm-hmm. And I think that these are all horrifying things that, you know, are in the back of our brain when we're doing our job. Mm-hmm. But I think it's kind of this other level when it's like your family being targeted, because I know so many journalists, myself included, we do so much work to keep our private lives private and not have the people that we love face the effects. But I think, you know, when I see people like Wael El Dadou, you know, he's attending a journalist attending a funeral for his son and reporting the next day just because he knows how important his role is. Mm-hmm. I think it's just my heart breaks every time.
No, of course, yeah. Concerning.
Very concerning. Yeah. I think I do have a couple clips to play that we could look at. You know, one of them I had mentioned before that, you know, it's not, the targeting of journalists isn't just happening right now. But, you know, there's a history of it, and this is something they discussed at the vigil that we could see.
If you are perhaps newer to the movement, and you're only just starting to learn about the history of the occupation, what you may not know is that the Zionist regime has been using this barbaric tactic since long before the beginning of the assault on Gaza. In 2022, Shirin Abu Akla, a distinguished reporter for Al Jazeera and a household name among Arabs, was killed in broad daylight by the Israeli occupation forces as she was wearing a visible blue vest with the word press very clearly and largely marked across it. The year before that, Israel carried out an air raid on a tower in Gaza, which housed multiple media offices, including the reputable and world-renowned Al Jazeera. In 2018, Yasser Murtaza, a photojournalist from Gaza, was shot dead by an Israeli sniper. His crime was photographing protests that were happening on the southern Gaza border. Like Shirin Abu Akla, he was also wearing a marked press vest as well as a helmet. The examples that I've given you here are a small fraction of the journalists that Israel has strategically targeted since 1948.
The vigil you attended, they're talking about, I guess the organizers of that protest were talking about the clear instances of these journalists being killed by either strikes or sniper fire, and I guess their argument, it seems to be, is that they had the clear markings, that press vests on, helmets, and that despite that kind of visibility that would identify them to whatever assaulting force, that they still kind of were killed.
And one of the names she brought up, Shirin Abu Akleh, she's a very celebrated, very well-known journalist in the Arab world, Al Jazeera journalist. She was shot in the head and killed by an Israeli forces officer in 2022. And I think this case is so important, specifically because it does show the shiftiness in Israel's response and the necessity of carrying out external investigations, and also holding all killings of journalists accountable. Essentially, right after this has happened, witnesses, including Al Jazeera journalists who were there, immediately said that Israel forces had carried out this shooting against Abu Akleh in Jenin. And this was backed up by, numerous investigations by media outlets, human rights organizations, and the UN. Right when this happened, Israel said that armed Palestinians who were firing indiscriminately had killed her. And then, days later, they said it might be Israel.
Mm.
It might be. Then, days after, an Israeli military official said, "We have narrowed down the Israeli army weapon that might have been involved in the fire exchange near Shireen." But he essentially stressed that the source of the shot was unclear. Then, from their own investigation, in September of that year, they said that it was highly likely that she was accidentally killed by Israeli army fire. So I think that if we're not, pushing for accountability of these deaths and pushing for the truth, I think that governments who are responsible for the killing of journalists, they will just let it slide. And
right,
they will be happy to not see it be brought up in the media. But I think that this investigation, their own investigation is not great. External investigation is way more important. But from their own investigation, they included that, it's highly likely.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, thank you for, giving more depth to the names that were brought up at the vigil. I think it's incredibly concerning. And I think very telling to see that. Such an interesting timeline for the Israeli Defense Forces to offer that. And you see how the kind of, I think what I really like about your timeline is you see how they try to deny it at first, or they try to create another kind of narrative about it, but then even, I don't know whether they knew or not at the beginning, but, even with their own internal investigation, it's like their denial changed to a highly likely, right? And I don't think we're going to get a definite yes from them, but it's incredible the power of outside pressure, right, that journalists usually offer, and here they are being murdered.
And this is such a trend in their reaction. Specifically, we're also seeing this with the hospitals and the first hospital that was bombed. It's not the first, it was the second hospital. I don't want to say the name to cause confusion, because
sure.
Anyway, it's on my phone.
Sure.
It's on my story right now, my Instagram story. But essentially, they had said that, Hamas has tunnels under the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Hamas is storing fuel. And journalists have really been pushing against this, saying that it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Israel is still pushing this narrative, but as of right now, we've not seen evidence that's been published that hasn't essentially been discredited. So I think that whether it be for the lives of journalists, the lives of civilians, or the indiscriminate bombing of infrastructure in Gaza, journalists play such an important role to the truth and holding people accountable. Something that Leah said really kind of stuck with me that I wanted to share. She said that the work journalists are doing is crucial and has even helped South Africa in bringing their case against Israel to the International Court of Justice. She said that the examples that the ICJ is using, specifically South Africa is using, are things that journalists are documenting on the ground in an attempt to bring justice. She says whether or not this case will be successful in terms of proving that Israel is guilty of genocide, and after that having some form of accountability and an end to this bombardment. She said that she's not sure if it will lead to accountability, identifying that essentially international law is flawed. And, we can really see how international law is flawed in the amount of journalists that are being killed without any accountability. As, I remind people, killing a journalist is a war crime.
Yeah. I mean, international law is such a slow-moving, like, I mean, we think of, like, the legal system is, like, kind of sort of designed that for that, where it takes these kinds of sort of disputes happening, whatever, like, interpersonally between organizations, entities, and it brings them into a courtroom where things get to be, like, really, like, every detail is hashed out, and just the nature of that it slows it down, right? And, like, every time you go from, like, every court level higher, so you have, like, let's say, municipal, provincial, the Supreme Court of Canada, and then, like, even going on to, like, the higher levels of, like, internet, like, multinational kind of laws, agreements like NAFTA, and then even the higher realm of, like, something like international, like, law, like, at the ICJ, it's such a slow-moving beast. And it's, like, if the accountability that might come out of that is going to be years away, right, which is something that's kind of, like, hard to see when you have, like, journalists being killed in such a slow time frame. But it's, I think there is, I guess, something useful about what Leah's saying about, or not that there's something useful, I think I agree with what Leah's saying, is that there's this utility, right, for journalists in discrediting these kind of main narratives, right, where you have, like, before you're talking about the main narrative that Israel and the IDF were kind of giving about Shireen's death, and then because of this kind of, like, the work from, like, outside, from other journalists who are kind of trying to, like, dig into that, trying to investigate themselves, you just have them being challenged, their narrative is challenged, and then they change their narrative, right? Mm-hmm. So without these journalists, who's going to challenge the narratives? And then are people just going to accept state narratives? I don't think so, but you don't have the kind of clear challenge to state narratives or the narratives of power. You don't have a clear challenge to that without journalists.
Absolutely. Something I wanted to bring up that I thought was kind of an interesting response is Leah and I had such a long conversation. I think I asked her for like 10 minutes and it turned into like 30 minutes. But it was really
good.
Great.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, no, it was a really lovely conversation. And at the end I asked her, you know, we did kind of discuss the amount, the lack of reaction and just kind of how, you know, some journalists, I guess maybe some, are, you know, publicizing their shock and not really doing much. But also there's not, I think something that I wondered in my lack of response from many is if some people don't think it's a threat to press freedoms. Mm-hmm. And I essentially asked her, you know, what would you say to journalists who aren't concerned about the mass loss of lives, journalists' lives, and if this could be a threat to press freedoms? I quote, "It's a question of our own professional ethics, to stand up for your colleagues and for anyone who cares for the values of this profession. There's no excuse to not advocate for colleagues. It's not a matter of being objective or being neutral, advocating for the very best, advocating for the very basic rights of our colleagues trying to do our job in Gaza or elsewhere." And I think that's such an important point because it's not, we're always forced to be neutral. My personal take is I think that we should just be upfront about our beliefs, mm-hmm. and, you know, show both sides to a story because that's, I think that that's accurate and important, mm-hmm. journalism. Mm-hmm. But if a massive amount of journalists are being killed with no accountability and even just being killed, I don't think it's taking a position to call that out. I think it's just standing up for our morals and standing up for our
colleagues,
profession,
like,
for our colleagues.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did have another...
Concerning.
Yeah. I'm leaving you speechless,
day.
Huh?
I mean, yeah, this is... I apologize. Usually I feel like I have things to say, but like I feel
okay.
like, I mean, the comments from these journalists you talk to, I feel like they just summarize it well themselves that... I don't want to add to mess up their statements.
Yeah, no, they said some really great things, and I could tell by our conversations, you know, this subject has really been on their minds, and you know, I don't want to encourage any journalists to be in distress necessarily, but I think it's a natural reaction to be in distress to see not only just what's going on in Gaza, but the way the whole industry is being threatened. And
of course. It's like you're saying, right? It's like, they're a journalist, I'm a journalist, just on that level of, like, we share the same profession. Much easier to put yourself in each other's shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to see that happen to colleagues, right, people who share the same profession, and there being no response, I guess it's like what you're saying, right? It's like, before, it's like, that could have been me. You know, as much as like we live in like a safe place, it's like if I was there, if I would have been there, I would have been in the same profession that could have happened to me. And then the response you would want is fucking like outpouring of like of support. People talk about. I mean, you do have that right at the vigil. It's great that we have this vigil for this. And I think I'm very heartened to see that. But it's so disproportionate, right, to the kind of violence that's being experienced by journalists.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, you said it. Very well said. And something that's come up, I know, in our past shows when I've given kind of critique on coverage in the Canadian media, Una brought it up. She said, in wartime, propaganda operations and disinformation are at their peak. So the lack of coverage in Gaza is a danger for disinformation. She added that this contributed to an imbalance in coverage, which influences public opinion, affecting the way both citizens and external governments alike understand the conflict. She had specifically brought up, cited reporting by Quebec media after October 7th, specifically calling out reporting by La Presse. She said that La Presse had arrived in the region, but disproportionately focused on the attacks by Hamas and, you know, the Israeli hostages, and kind of not provided the same sort of space towards what's happening to Gazans. She said that, you know, she suspects they either fell, they being La Presse, fell to Israeli propaganda or couldn't really cover Gazans' perspectives because they were barred by Israel from entering, which is something many journalist organizations and independent journalists are, you know, being barred from entering Gaza. And her, you know, critique on Quebec media and as well Canadian media, it is something that was brought up at this vigil. I think they specifically called Canadian media cowardly, something to that extent. We could check out the next clip to see what they say.
While Palestinian journalists have been risking their lives every single day to showcase the world the brutality of Israel's genocidal campaign, Canadian news networks have been shamefully complicit. The language that Canadian media uses grossly minimizes the war crimes committed by Israel, which in the end further dehumanizes Palestinians. These networks have repeatedly chosen not to report the horrors and the violence that Palestinians endure, including underreporting the civilian death count, while at the same time reproducing Israeli state-sponsored propaganda. This pattern reflects not only a lack of courage, but a moral bankruptcy on the part of the CBC, CTV, The Globe and Mail, The National Post, and every other mainstream Canadian news source. They have towed the line by quietly admitting that Palestinian civilians and journalists have been killed, but their honesty, their backbone, and their journalistic integrity does not go further than that. It does not extend to holding the Zionist state accountable for its crimes against humanity. For that, Palestinian journalists have paid the ultimate price.
Damn.
Yeah.
Solid speech after solid, heavy speech. Yeah. So, I mean, the speaker was kind of calling out, listed them as well, the major Canadian institutions that, media institutions that have been silent, I guess, in the proportion to the violence happening right now in Gaza and West Bank and Palestine. These protesters sound fed up. It sounds like they want more coverage of it. Sounds like they want. It sounds like they find the coverage completely inadequate to the level of violence going on, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that on the show we've been kind of critiquing for a few months now, as well as, you know, in the West we have this kind of interesting, I guess, reaction by media outlets, whether it's, you know, taking sides, not necessarily using proper language, and also, you know, the job loss of journalists who do kind of stand out.
Of course, do speak up. Yeah,
yeah, do speak up. Yeah, it's heavy, but I think it's, you know, really admirable for journalists who do speak up and, you know, are so passionate about this issue, and I wish that we could all be.
Passionate
and, you know, taking a stand and being horrified for the future of journalism, the threat to press freedoms, and not silently horrified or, you know, horrified on social media, but, you know, maybe act to bring together like a call to action.
Yeah. Curious to see if any calls to action will be popping up in the wake of this. We'll see. These are historic times we're living in. And yeah, no, things continue to surprise me. I think this is kind of weird, like, desensitization, I guess, that happens to it, right? When you're, like, witness to this kind of stuff, where it started becomes the norm. But I think it's the importance of these vigils, the importance of your reporting as well, to kind of keep this at the front of people's minds, as much as people want to recoil away from it or rely on new media organizations that don't really cover it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for always having me on to talk about this.
Of course. Thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show, folks. We'll be back next week. Same time, same place. I don't know what else to say. Take care.